at the feast one year, similar sermon, I guess you should say, and I've given this sermon two or three times in other congregations that I had. And every time I give this sermon, people come up to me and they say they know who I'm talking about. And sometimes they'll tell me numerous names. I'm thinking it can't be. I'm not talking about any person. I'm talking about an attitude. And I'm talking about a situation that is not good and something that each and every one of us needs to be aware of in our own life. So that would be my comment for all of us, including myself. And the subject is narcissism. Now you think, oh, what's that? Narcissism. Well, narcissists are bad. They're really bad. And often they're conniving. They're sneaky bad. And now, where did this term come from? And if you look at a history book, I mean, I just went into Wikipedia, because the term narcissism came from the name of a supposedly Greek god. Now, look, I know there's not a Greek god, so don't get all worried about that. But Narcissus is his name. And he, in legend, he was rejected in his desperate advances of this particular lady. And it caused him to fall in love with his own reflection in a pool of water. So he just sat hour after hour after hour looking at his reflection in the water. What a way to spend your life. You know, not really a very profitable way to spend your life. But if you look at Webster's Dictionary, which is, I guess, as good a place to look as any, here's the definition of narcissism. It's N-A-R-C-I-S-S-I-S-M if you're trying to figure out how to spell it. But the definition of narcissism is this: an inordinate fascination with oneself. An inordinate fascination with oneself, excessive self-love, vanity. So that's just the definition right out of the encyclopedia or dictionary: inordinate fascination with oneself, excessive self-love, and vanity. Now, we all have to fight that, don't we? All of us have vanity. All of us have pride. All of us have situations that we could take a look at and really need to consider. Now, there was a book by a man by the name of Scott Peck, and it was entitled People of the Lie, and the book was about this subject of narcissism. And he made this quote in this book. He said, you know, the title, People of the Lie. He said, the lie being that on the surface, they often appear to be nice people. You know, a lot of times you see politicians, entertainers, you know, various sundry people like that, that on the surface appear to be nice people, but they live a lie, thinking they fully deserve all the attention they feel others should give them. Well, look at all these entertainers and politicians and athletes sometimes. They think they're so important, don't they? They think everybody should be following whatever they should do, and they think the whole world, in a sense, revolves around them and their whatever position it is, whether it be a politician, an entertainer. I've had so many people come to me and say, oh, yeah, that's talking about, well, probably it is. You know, we all have to look at this in ourselves. That's the point I'm trying to make. Now, he mentioned in this book, and I thought this was fascinating. Peck said that narcissists are often attracted to churches. Often attracted to churches because they think their ideas are better than others. Well, we look at all the years that we've attended services and look at the carnage along the way of people that have dropped along the side because they didn't get their way. It's amazing. He said, their way, though, is how they think others should do things. According to Peck, in reality, these people are controllers. They have large egos working to get their own way. Continuing in his quote, he said, one of the most common ploys of a narcissist is to put on a pity party for oneself, or on the other hand, they get petulant or angry against anyone they think is an opponent of theirs. Disarmingly crafty, they work to get control over a situation to work it in their favor. That's just a quote from the book. Now turn on the news today. Notice entertainers, athletes, politicians, powerful of the world. We see this trait of narcissism quite frequently. And the world is full of this attitude. and it seems to be growing all the time. Now, it's rather easy to see this attitude in others, but as I said, I'd like for each of us to consider ourselves and look at ourselves as we consider this subject today. Now, possibly, in fact, I think, and in the Bible, the best example of a narcissist in the Bible would be the story of Absalom, one of David's sons. Let's turn to 2 Samuel 18. Now, this is not the end of the story, but this probably is all you really need to know about Absalom, 2 Samuel 18. So, we're going to take a look at him a little bit here this afternoon, but here's a classic to me. Verse 18 of 2 Samuel 18. This is what Absalom thought about himself. Now, Absalom in his lifetime, he had taken to set up a pillar or a monument for himself. Absalom built a monument honoring himself. What, isn't it supposed to be when they put together a monument that you honor a person? Well, he's honoring himself because he was so proud of himself. So Absalom, in his lifetime, so not after he died, but in his lifetime, he set up a pillar or a monument for himself, which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name. And to this day, it's called Absalom's Monument. I'd say the ego is rather large there, would you not, of Absalom? Now, I've visited England before for the feast, and I remember going to England and after the feast on a little tour of London. And they were taken around to Westminster Abbey. It was the place I remember the most. And there were all these monuments of all these so-called famous people. But the thing I remember the most about the, I don't even remember for sure who all the monuments were of. You know, there's some of the famous politicians and leaders of England. But the thing I noticed the most is how the pigeons were all just dropping their refuge. These monuments needed to rain quite a bit to keep these monuments clean. Isn't it amazing? Well, let's take a look at Absalom here. Let's turn back to 2 Samuel chapter 3 to begin. 2 Samuel 3. Verse 2. Sons were born to David. So here's King David. He had several sons. Sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahimanoah the Jezreelitess. His second son was Chileab by Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. And we could take a look at each one of these people because they're all described in the Bible, but we don't have time for that. But David's third son that was born in Hebron was Absalom, the son of Micah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. So Absalom, the daughter of Absalom, is born into royalty. David was a king, and so was Geshur. He was king of Geshur. Talmai was king of Geshur. So Absalom was born into royalty on both sides. So he had a very impressive beginning, I guess you could say. The fourth son of David was Adonijah. We could read about him. Each of these, I won't go into each of them, but they were born to David in Hebron, the first five verses. So Absalom was born to royalty on both sides, David's side and his wife's side. Now, he was quite a handsome guy. But what kind of character did Absalom have? Well, I'm going to turn, you might want to keep your place in 2 Samuel, but I'm just going to turn to Proverbs 31 for a second. Proverbs 31. And read a verse that I know you're familiar with. I know you probably read it many times. But right at the very end of Proverbs, after it's talking about the virtuous wife, the very end of Proverbs in verse 30, it says something very, very telling. It says, charm is deceitful. Charm is deceitful. And beauty is vain. You know, beauty is vain. I mean, no matter how beautiful, no matter how strong you are or how impressive you are, over time it goes away, does it not? So it says, charms deceitful, beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Now, I'm just concentrating on that thing, charm is deceitful. You know, Absalom had all kind of charm, but it was deceitful charm. He lacked character. Charm is not something people are born with. It's a developed skill. And charm, if you look at the definition of charm, it's the power to allure delight. So Absalom had this trait. He would turn on the charm to people to get his way. But often charm is associated with handsome or attractive personalities or entertainers or athletes or politicians. But it is a trait. It's not just to have charm doesn't make you a good person. Now, 2 Samuel, let's turn to chapter 14. We'll jump along here. 2 Samuel chapter 14. You want to get a look at how Absalom thought about himself? Well, it's fairly obvious. He was rather vain when you turn to verse 25 of 2 Samuel 14. It says, now in all of Israel, there was no one who was praised as much as Absalom for what? For his good looks. Hey, he must have been a stunning person to look at physically. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. Well, that lets all of us out, doesn't it? There was no blemish in Absalom. Man, what a man. And when he cut his hair, at the end of every year, he cut his hair because it was heavy on him. So he must have loved that hair. He weighed a whole year, cut his hair once a year. When he cut it, he weighed the hair of the head at 200 shekels according to the king's standard. So Absalom was born three sons and one daughter, whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful, beautiful girl. So what about the monument? He had children. So why would he need to make a monument to himself? Because he said he had no sons. Well, right here he said he had three, didn't he? So something's not right there. Well, Absalom used his charm to his own self. He had good personality, I'm sure, but he was deceitful. He developed probably a verbal eloquence, yet he was manipulative and he completely turned inward on himself. He put every angle. If you read, we can't read the entire story for time's sake, but he played every angle for himself. He had a spoiled and vicious character that was only for himself. Everything basically in Absalom's life was to get what he wanted. Not what was best for others, but for what he wanted. Now we can read the story of how he kills his brother Amnon. And his brother Amnon had actually raped his sister. And he killed his brother. And yes, his brother Amnon was terrible. But we can read that story. But Absalom, he decided to take justice by himself. And again, but then after he did this, he was sent away by his father, David. Let's look at a few verses here. Let's turn back to chapter 13. Chapter 13, verse 37, 38, and 39, talking about this. You see, David sent Absalom away into what do you want to call it? He sent him away after this hideous act that he made. And David had a right to do that, but was David a very good father? Well, in some ways, I would say no. But Absalom, verse 37, he fled and he went to Talmai. Well, who was he? Well, he was the father of the king, the son, I should say, of the king of Geshur, which we read about right the first. And David, after he sent his son Absalom away, David mourned for his son every day. Every day that Absalom was gone, David was hurting because he loved Absalom, but of course he was torn between several ways. So Absalom fled. He went to Geshur. He was there 3 years. For 3 years, Absalom was there in Geshur, where the king was. And King David longed to go to Absalom because he had been comforted concerning Amnon, because Amnon was now dead. So after time, you know, he was moving on. Now, chapter 14, Absalom decided he wanted to come back home and didn't know how to get back home. and he wanted to get his way. Well, in verse 1 of chapter 14, Joab. Now, there's a quite a guy, Joab. We could give a story on him, sermon on him, because Joab was a conniving person in many, many ways. In fact, when David died, he told his son to make sure Joab did not go to his grave in peace. And we could turn to 1 Kings and 1 Kings chapter 1 and possibly chapter 2, and we could read about what happened to Joab. But right now, Joab, the son of Zeruiah, he perceived that the king's heart was concerned about Absalom, that David was mourning for his son. So Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman. And Joab said to this woman, please, now here's deceit right here. Joab says, please pretend to be a mourner and put on your mourning apparel. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but act like a woman who has been mourning for a long time for the dead. In other words, Joab told her, we need to try to trick David, the king. So the king, he said, go to the king and speak to him in this manner. So Absalom, or David, Joab, as you said, put the words in her mouth and told her what to say. Now, again, we could read on, but let's drop down to verse 28. Because David forgave him and let Absalom come home, but he still wasn't ready to talk to him. So in verse 28 of chapter 14, again, dropping down a bit, so Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem, but did not see the king's face. So he was allowed to come home, but David still hadn't seen him. Therefore, Absalom sent to Joab, and he said, send him to the king, but he would not come to him. And when he had sent a second time, Joab still wouldn't come to Absalom. So he said to his servants, Absalom said, see that field over there that's Joab's? He has barley over there in that field. Go set it on fire. And Absalom's servants came and went and set Joab's field on fire. Why did he do that? Because Joab wasn't doing his bidding. He wasn't coming to him. And Absalom said, Joab, doesn't he, what's that old term? Do you know who I am? So Joab, after the fire was set in the field, Joab arose, he came to Absalom's house, and he said, why have your servants set my field on fire? An obvious question. And Absalom answered Joab, look, just think about it. Listen to how he's the words here. Look, I sent to you. I said, come here, that I may send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? You know, why did I come home if the king won't see me? It would be better for me to be still there. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face. But if there's any iniquity in me, let him execute me. Do you think he really wanted to be executed? He was throwing the gauntlet down. I want attention. And Joab, you weren't giving me the attention I wanted. So I petulantly told my servants to go set your field on fire. You're going to listen to me. I'm Absalom. It's basically what he was saying. So Joab went to the king. He told him. And when he called for Absalom, the king called to Absalom. David called to Absalom. He came to the king. He bowed himself on the face of the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. Seems like a nice ending to the story, but it's not the end. Verse 1 of chapter 15. Now after this, after David accepted Absalom back, after this it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. He needed attention. Okay, he got sent away for... Then he's let to come back. Then the king wouldn't see him. Then Joab wouldn't do what he wanted. He burns Joab's field down. Then you got Joab to go to King David. And David said, okay, welcome you back, Absalom. But even after he was back, Absalom decided he was a lot more important than this. So he provided himself with chariots and horses. He had 50 men to run before him. Now Absalom would rise early in the morning, stand beside the way to the gate. So it was when anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for decision, that Absalom would say to him, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Well, your servant is from such and such a place, from what tribe of Israel?" And Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right. There's no deputy of the king to hear you." He's saying, "Man, you're not getting treated right. What are we going to do about it?" He was saying. Remember, charm is deceitful, beauty is vain. Can just be a personality trait. Then moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made a judge in the land. Because if everyone who had a case or a suit or a cause would come to me, I would give him justice." Meaning, his father David may not have been giving the justice in Absalom's mind. So it was, whenever anyone came near to him to bow down to him, they would put out his hand and take him and kiss him, or kiss his greeting of the hand. In this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. By deceit, by trickery, Absalom formed a rebellion. And he stole the hearts of the men and women, of course, of Israel by trickery and lies and deceit. Remember the definition of a narcissist? Inordinate fascination with oneself, excessive self-love, vanity. Absalom was so proud of himself that he only cut his hair once a year. Absalom was so proud of himself that probably he thought he deserved everything and then some. One would ask ourselves, how did this work? Well, let's go back to the book written by F. Scott Peck, talking about narcissists. Remember what he said? He said, on the surface, they often appear to be nice people. Don't you think Absalom appeared to be a nice person to those that came to him for help? And he said, "Yes, yes, yes, I'll help you." Yet he said, they live a lie, thinking they fully deserve all the attention they feel others should give them. Well, can I be tricked? Can you be tricked by flattery, by words, by telling you things? Well, I think it's easy to see if we turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Paul was speaking to the Corinthian church, and he made it very plain, very clear about how we can be deceived. Excuse me. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 3 through 7. Actually, I'm just going to read verse 7. Verse 7. Do you look at things according to outward appearance? Do you look at things according to outward appearance? Paul was asking the Corinthian church. If anyone is convinced in himself that he is Christ, let him again consider this in himself, that just as he is Christ, even so we are Christ. Because these false ministers were coming in to the Corinthian church and saying, Paul's not a true minister. But yet, as you read about Paul, I don't really see Paul anything but totally honest and upfront at all times. Verse 8, for even if I should boast somewhat about my own authority, which the Lord gave us, for edification and not for your instruction, I shall not be ashamed, lest I seem to terrify you by letters. For his letters, they say, are weighty and powerful, but his body appearance or presence is weak, and his speech contemptible. Paul was not a great eloquent speaker, evidently, but yet Paul spoke the truth. It wasn't about flattery. It wasn't about pumping himself up. It was about preaching the truth. Let such a person consider this, he said, that what we are in word, by letter, when we're absent, such we will be indeed when we are present. So Paul is saying, don't look at the outward appearance. Look at what's being done, said. Don't fall for flattery. Don't fall for rumor and innuendo. Man, it's gone on as long as I can remember, and it'll continue to go on. This rumor and innuendo of trying to flatter and get a person's own way, whether it be in the church or whether it be in our job or whether it be, you know, you name it. It's all around in this world, this excessive self-love of ourself. Hey, we all have to fight it. It's not something that you can say, man, I'm sure I don't have that problem. Every one of us have to fight that excessive self-love of ourselves. Let's look at chapter 11 of 2 Corinthians, verse 1 through 4. Paul said, oh, that you would bear with me just with a little folly. And indeed you do bear with me. What was he talking about? He says, I'm jealous for you, Corinthian church. I'm jealous for you with a godly jealousy. He wasn't jealous because he wanted power. He wanted to control things. He wanted to tell everybody else how to do things and make sure you do it the way I tell you, or it's not. You know, Paul was not out there trying to boss people around and tell them how great he was, but he was an apostle. He spoke the truth in letters and in deed. He says, I betrothed you to one husband. What is that? To Jesus Christ. But I fear, he said, lest somehow as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness. Remember the serpent told Eve, oh, you're not going to die? And yet Eve listened to the serpent instead of what God said. And then Adam listened to Eve. And we know the story. He says, I fear, like that's how that serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted. From what? The simplicity that is in Christ. God's way, the Bible, God's truth is not complicated. It's not complicated. The Trinity is complicated because it doesn't make sense. All these, you know, various things that people will say, oh yeah, you've got to believe that, but yet it's not in the Bible. If it's not in the Bible, it's in the Bible, it's not that complicated. But yet, Satan never changes his tricks, the way he does things. So he says, verse 4, for if he who comes preaches another Jesus, whom you have not preached, or whom we have not preached, Paul said, or if you receive a different spirit, which you've not received, or a different gospel, which you have not accepted, you may well put up with it. He said, you are falling for a trick. Remember, he said, the simplicity that is in Christ. God's way is not the complicated way. It's the clear way. I remember one time I was asked to go on a visit several years ago, and I went on a visit with an elder. We were both there, and we went to visit this man. He lived way back, I don't even remember the name of the town, but it was not anywhere close by from where we had lived. And this man, he was a very nice guy, but he had told us that he wanted us to visit him because he decided he was going to make a change in his life. And he said, I've decided I'm going to do one of two things. I'm either going to be an elder in the Worldwide Church of God or a worm farmer. I thought, what's a worm farmer? I thought, well, that's not putting up. He's going to either be a minister in the Worldwide Church of God or a worm farmer. Well, when the man and I left, we looked at each other and we said, I think he should be the worm farmer, don't you? Because he just put himself forward. Continue in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Let's look at verse 13, 14, and 15. Paul's continuing to tell the Corinthian church something. He says, for such are false apostles, these people that have a different gospel and a different spirit. They're deceitful workers. They transform themselves into apostles of Christ, but they aren't. They say things, they twist it around, but they aren't telling the truth. And no wonder, he said, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. But he's no angel of light, is he? No. Therefore, Paul said, it's no great thing if his ministers, whose ministers? Satan's ministers, also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works. Does this world society as a whole understand the morals of this world compared to God's true morals? You know, we create our false morals, and people call me all the time or contact me all the time, and they'll say they're looking for this or looking for that, but then oftentimes they're wanting to come to a church that fits whatever they want it to be. But yet the Bible is where we find the truth. It's in the Bible. It's not in our own minds that we come up with ideas and things. It's from the Bible. I think I said this the other day in Bible study, but I remember so clearly a minister coming back to Nashville when I lived there saying what God expects of a New Testament Christian is to keep the Sermon on the Mount, which he does. But then he goes on and says, not the Ten Commandments. Now you tell me what in the Sermon on the Mount contradicts the Ten Commandments. It's nothing, does it? But yet it sounds real good. It sounds real good. He said the standard of a New Testament Christian is not the Ten Commandments or God's laws. It's the Sermon on the Mount. And yet it is the same thing. Some bought into this. They started stating this as fact rather than man's opinion. I remember when all this stuff went on down in Nashville about, I don't know, maybe a year later, a member that used to attend church with me who had just completely thrown it all away and he was moving to another house. He and his family were moving to another house and he had a number of people over to help him move, and he had contacted me and asked me if I'd help him move, and I was glad to help him move. I was glad to help him. But I was the only person there that still attended church. All the rest of them were all over the place. And when we were driving, he asked me if I would ride with him over to the new house in his car. So we were riding along together. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, Stan, if we would just quit worrying about doctrine, we could all get along better. I didn't even know what to say. If we wouldn't worry about doctrine, why have a church? If God didn't worry about doctrine, why would God have a church? The church is built on God's doctrines. And yet he says, why are we worrying about doctrines? We'll get along a lot better if we don't worry about these doctrines. Let's look at Revelation chapter 5. This is what God tells Christians through the Apostle John as he wrote Revelation. And they sang a new song in this vision that John saw. Said, you're worthy, praising God, and praising Jesus Christ and God the Father. You're worthy to take the scroll, to open its seals, for you were slain. So he's talking about Jesus Christ. You were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood, out of every tribe, out of every tongue, and every people, every nation. It's all inclusive, isn't it? Christians are those who keep God's laws, not what nationality or country or race or any of that. And have made us kings and priests. That's what will be the end result, is it not? Have made us kings and priests to our God. We shall reign on earth. How often have our leaders in this world lied to us? How often have religious leaders and people that we've known over the years said they weren't true? I knew an associate pastor once that moved in an area, and he called me up after a while and started telling me that things weren't being done correctly. And problem was, to my knowledge, they were being done correctly, but he didn't like the way it was done. Once he specifically called me and said he didn't think it was right that I wasn't helping conduct the Passover. Well, I didn't really care who conducted the Passover as long as it was done by, the way God instructed. I didn't care if I was helping with the Passover, but he wanted to just keep pushing it in. And I thought, well, it doesn't matter to me. Then later he called me up and he asked me if I'd be the executor of his will in case he died. And I said, okay. It was a somewhat simple will. But I noticed one thing. He asked if I would have something printed on his tombstone. And what he asked me to have printed on his tombstone was, "Here lies a man of God." Sounded okay. But you know what? Less than a year later, this man had all types of morality issues. He basically, let's put it this way, he did all types of despicable things. In fact, he had to be fired from the church, from the organization, because of what he did. But yet, he wanted me to make sure that if he died, I put on his tombstone, "Here lies a man of God." Sadly, over the years, I think we have had men, women we respected lie to us. Lie to us. I remember when I first got here, I made a comment, "I'll never lie to you." And I've had people say, "I'm going to hold you to that. If I lie to you, please turn me in. Because I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to not make mistakes. I'm not going to always do things perfectly, as you are well aware of. But we don't lie. And I don't like it when people lie to me. And yet, when they lie to me, I don't really wonder. I sometimes wonder why. Just like that man that came back to Nashville and said the standard of a Christian is not the Ten Commandments. Why would he say that? I could continue to give the story of Absalom, but you know how he died. His hair that he cut once a year got caught in a tree. And then Joab went by to make sure he was killed. His vanity, I guess you could say his hair, got caught in a tree as he tried to form a rebellion and did a rebellion against David. Now, I don't have time to go through that whole story, but you can read it. But Absalom rebelled against David, and in the end, Absalom was seen for what he was. It's a tragic story. It's a sad story. But Absalom was so involved in himself that he didn't have time to think about anyone but himself. Now let's turn to 2 Samuel 18. 2 Samuel 18. Verse 9. Then this is when the rebellion of Absalom is going and David's men are fighting Absalom. Verse 8. For the battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. Then Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode on a mule. And the mule went under the thick boughs of the great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth. So he was left hanging between heaven and earth. And the mule which he was under him went on. So here he's dangling by his hair. Now a certain man saw it and told Joab, good old Joab. And Joab said, I just saw Absalom hanging on the tree. So Joab said to the man who told him, you just saw him? And you didn't strike him there to the ground? What did David tell Joab? Do not harm my son Absalom, despite what Absalom was doing. But yet Joab was also a narcissist, because he was in it for himself too. Joab said, "You didn't strike him there? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt if you'd just gone out and killed him." Then the man said to Joab, "Though I will receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I wouldn't raise my hand against the king's son. For our hearing, the king commanded you, Absalom, and he commanded Abishai and Ittai, saying, 'Beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom. Don't hurt him,' King David had said. 'Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely with my own life,' this man said, 'for there is nothing hidden from the king. And you yourself would have set yourself against me.' And Absalom, or Joab said, 'I can't linger with you.'" In modern words, "Oh, get out of here." "And he took 3 spears in his hand. He thrust them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree. And 10 young men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom, struck him, and killed him. Joab blew the trumpet. The people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab held back the people. And they took Absalom, and they cast him in a large pit in the woods, and they laid a very large heap of stones over him. Then all Israel fled, everyone to his tent." And remember verse 18. "Now Absalom in his lifetime before this had taken up and set up a pillar for himself, which is in the king's valley. For he said, 'I have no son to keep my name in remembrance.'" Well, he had kids. "And he called the pillar after his own name. And to this day, at that particular time, it was still there, called Absalom's Monument." How many men and women over the years have set up a monument to themselves? They are so concerned about getting their own way that they do not worry about truth. They do not worry about honor. They just worry about their own way. I remember a story, a lady in the church talking about, she was standing around the water cooler one morning before work on a Monday morning. There were about 5 or 6 sort of fellow employees, and one of them asked the question, "What would you rather have, live forever or $1,000,000? And she said, every one of them said, "Hey, forget, I'll take the money." And she said, "Well, I'd like to live forever." The church member wanted to live forever. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. You know, in the end, we're saved by the mercy of God and by the grace of God and by God's great kindness. We were born because of God's great kindness and His mercy. In the end, nobody gets away with anything. And in the end, God is merciful if we are loyal to God's truth. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, just one verse, it's so telling, it's so clear, it's so obvious. Paul said, verse 19, 1 Corinthians 15, "If in this life only we have hope in Christ, we are all of all men the most to be pitied, if this is the end of the story." But some people can't catch the vision. It's all about taking and getting in this life. And yet, we all have to look at ourselves, because it could apply to any of us at any time, could it not? Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2, as we draw toward a conclusion. Breaking in to verse 6. Now, I could have read the verses before, but beginning in verse 6 of Romans 2. Who God will render to each one according to his deeds, but not according to how, you're not saved by your works, but yet you're saved by God's grace, but yet a Christian will obey God's laws. Or otherwise, we're not a Christian. Eternal life to those who by patient endurance in doing seek glory, seek honor, seek immortality. That's what that woman on the water cooler, she wanted immortality. She wanted to live forever in the kingdom of God. But to those who are self-seeking and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation, wrath, tribulation, anguish to every soul of man who does evil, of the Jew first and also the Greek. But glory and honor and peace to everyone who works what is good, to the Jew first and also the Greek, for there is no partiality with God. What does God really want from each of us? Absalom wanted fame. Absalom wanted power. Absalom wanted all these things that are temporary. Now, in this Wikipedia, I just looked, it said traits and signs of a narcissist. Now, I say this, I need to look at this myself. All of us need to look at ourselves. I can look out in the world and see all these examples of narcissism, but we need to look at ourselves, and we need to be aware of what goes on around us. Traits and signs of a narcissist. It says there's four dimensions of narcissism. Some crave leadership and authority. Some go for superiority and arrogance. Some self-willed absorption and self-admiration. And some exploitiveness and entitlement. Covers them all. But in this book, here are the traits of a narcissist. An obvious self-focus in interpersonal exchanges. It's all about them. Number two, problems in sustaining satisfying relationships. Number three, difficulty with empathy. Have a hard time feeling sorry for other people. Next one, problems distinguishing the self from others. It's all about them. Now, next one, hypersensitivity to any insults or imagined insults. What? You insult me? You know, basically that type of thing. Who are you? Vulnerability to shame rather than guilt. Haughty body language. Flattery towards people who admire and affirm them. Detesting those who do not admire them. Using other people without considering the cost of doing so. Pretending to be more important than they actually are. It's like, I always think, do you know who I am? Not a lot. Bragging. Exaggerating their achievements. Claiming to be an expert in many things. Inability to view the world from the perspective of other people. And finally, denial of remorse or gratitude. You know, every time I gave this sermon, people would come up, they'd talk about somebody or what, a boss or a political leader, entertainer. I mean, there's plenty of narcissists out there. But as I said, you and I, we look at ourselves, do we not? So many in this world basically live only for themselves. Yet in the end, it's all about what? Well, Ecclesiastes. I think we'll close with Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Why do we push and shove and fight to get our way in life? It seems to be something that's rather baffling at times, but we all have that tendency. We all can get that tendency, but yet we need to be aware of it. We need to be aware of it in whatever area of our life we're in. Here is the final two verses of Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13 and 14. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter when it's all said and done. Fear God and keep His commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every work into judgment. What are we doing? Let's not kid ourselves. It could happen to anyone. Any real or imagined power can go to our heads, and who knows where it can lead to. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing. We're not kidding anybody. None of us are worthy of anything, are we? We strive for perfection, but we're not there. But we need to strive for it, and we need to... You know what I'm saying. We strive to be like Jesus Christ. And yet, we look at ourselves and we think, man, I got a long way to go. But yet, he's merciful, but he expects us to move forward. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing. All the rumors, innuendos, and quite frankly, lies will all come to the surface. Whether it's good or whether it's evil, there are secret things that are good. Sometimes people do all these things. They don't want any praise for it. They're just wanting to serve to be a Christian. Narcissists are bad. They're really bad. They're often conniving, sneaky, bad. We don't want to be a narcissist.